has come to give what's mine.
Neil Young on Planet Waves FM Pacifica Radio Network. This is the portion of our program called Tantra Studio. However, I am once again astonished at the beauty of Neil Young's writing and music. And I mean, the songs are so beautiful. But as a writer, I have always been completely taken by his writing. And writing means song construction, but just simply the way that he puts words together. And this is a person who is adept at the use of metaphor and writes his songs that work on many levels. What you just heard was First Expecting to Fly from late 1967, released the following year, or maybe it came out in late. It was definitely recorded in 67 as part of, I just learned, a Neil Young solo album that didn't happen, and so it was released as a Buffalo Springfield song, even though he's the only person on it, to my knowledge. If my source on this is my musical history oracle, Michael B. Ackerman, one of my oldest friends, my personal guide to the New York music scene in the late 70s and early 80s. He had a car and was very smart and still doing his thing in L.A. as an entertainment lawyer, followed by Thrasher from the 1979 album Rust Never Sleeps. You cannot go wrong with that one. Side one, acoustic, with this fabulous 12-string guitar. And side two, electric, with songs like Powderfinger. Oh, my God. I mean, every song is just a memorable event. And the lyrics to Thrasher have stuck with me since I first heard them. I'm going to read you a little bit of it. He says, "I searched out my companions who were lost in crystal canyons, when the aimless blade of science slashed the pearly gates. It was then that I knew I'd had enough and burned my credit cards for fuel, headed out to where the pavement turns to sand, with a one-way ticket to the land of truth and my suitcase in my hand. How I lost my friends, I still don't understand." He's talking about something specific here. This is the 1960s. There are many friends lost. And this song concludes. I'm going to read two stanzas. Where the vulture glides descending on an asphalt highway bending through libraries and museums, galaxies and stars, down the windy halls of friendship to the rose clipped by the bullwhip, the motel of lost companions waits with heated pool and bar. But me, I'm not stopping there. I got my own row left to hoe. Just another line in the field of time. When the thrasher comes, I'll be stuck in the sun like the dinosaurs in shrines, but I'll know the time has come to give what's mine. well, yeah. Tantra. My presentation tonight is called Trust, Trance, and Tantra. I promise to begin with a definition of Tantra with every program, lest it be mistaken for some other thing available in the bookstore or that shows up on the internet, you know, involving bindis and pujas and things like that. My concept of Tantra is that it is the study and exploration of sex, sexuality, and sexual relationships in all their forms, including to yourself, as a metaphor for existence. So Tantra is not merely the study of sex. That's the Kinsey Report. Many places to, well, not so many anymore, but, you know, read about just the sex part. But to engage that as a study in existence is the step, is the tantric step. And because our existence is the product of sex, it is the perfect fit. Because as people born of sex, we are sex. And though there are many who would fight that idea and deny it, and who do, they cannot deny where they came from, how they ended up in this world. And to oppose in some way, in any way, oppose or resist or something, the very thing that created you would seem to me to be an existential situation. And so in embracing creation and life, in my tantric view, that is the embrace of sexuality. And as we look at it all, we can see where these seemingly different things all weave together. Now, in our time, there is, well, much of what passes for sex, and many of the ways that sex and sexuality are experienced are through the digital realm. And if they're not through the digital realm, everything that we experience is in the context of all of us being somehow part of or influenced by, transformed by the digital realm. And so there is no getting out of this. But what there is striving to figure out where you are and who you've become under the influence of digital, for those who are not digital natives, who have the ability to remember what we were before all of this. And for those who are digital natives, and it's always interesting to find out, like, who had the computer in the house at what age and what you know, when the cell phone arrived and all of that stuff. Though at a certain point, computing devices and communication by computers were ubiquitous, and so the transformation long precedes the appearance of the technology on the level where you can say, oh, that's one of those things. So there's many digital natives, and, you know, we're all under the digital ocean, like SpongeBob SquarePants. And there's a, you know, there's some issues there, because it's very challenging to perceive the environment that you are in. Now, special states of mind allow for this. Art is one of the great tools of perceiving the environment and also showing others the environment. Art is a probe. It is the act of a mind engaging with its environment in a conscious and curious way. And it is the guiding light in pretty much any generation. The artists who are awake and who are striving to be awake and are not letting their tools either put them to sleep or are enamored of the power of them, or the more serious problem, and I think it may be what, you know, distinguishes the non-artistic state from the artistic state, is that these power tools increase sensitivity, and the volume and the intensity of the information and the spread of the nervous system to every corner of the globe and every mind of every person, and suddenly in the digital sense we're all linked into one another and can be texting people in Nairobi casually riding the New York City subway. And it is very tempting to cut off because that just gets so intense. And part of the trance that we're in now is the trance of people backing off from the intensity. And in a sense, inducing a kind of anesthetic state that becomes the digital trance. When computers, well, when the internet first arrived, when computers arrived, they weren't really so much communication tools. I mean, they didn't have email for a long time. We did a lot of mailing disks around and printing and faxing things and driving over to somebody's house and, you know, trading hard drives and all of this stuff. There weren't PDFs. The whole thing wasn't portable. It was a bunch of independent terminals sitting on the desk, though it was easy for me to envision a time when they would all be connected, but they weren't. And then they all became connected, and it was very exciting to communicate through what was then initially email, message boards, kind of chat rooms. This is where a lot of the communication went on. A lot of it was group communication, party line type communication. You could then switch to personal message, a little like Facebook is today, only it was so different than what had come before it that, to me, my first experiences on the internet in like maybe 95 or so, and then I started personally putting up my own content in 98, were like experiences of being weightless. And that's actually true in the sense that when you enter the cybersphere, you don't bring your body with you. You are weightless. And it is a kind of a living dream. And one of the first things I noticed was that friendships could stir up very quickly, could form very quickly. And also, it was possible just to blank someone, to stop responding to them, and to delete them, in a sense. And for those of us who are sensitive and polite, this was shocking to feel and to experience that people had the power just to delete each other. Now, lovers have vanished, and friends go away and all of this, but not exactly like this. This just made it very convenient for people to blank one another. And there was the issue of who you're really talking to. There was a lot of pen names and handles and things like this, and you enter cyberspace without sex or gender, and so you can become anyone in cyberspace. And so there's this question of like, who is this really? And this, I think, has as an underlying feature some real questions of trust. Of you're in this existence, and you might be opening up to someone, and then you find out that they just you're having this incredible conversation, and then they're just gone, whatever the reason, they've deleted you. Today we've gotten used to that, I think. From those very early times in the late 90s, the internet quickly became a mostly hostile place. The original internet communities and academia and places like The Well thrived on a kind of congeniality in the communication. And as the internet began to reach more and more people, and as the devoid of feeling non-physical nature of the internet began to transform people, it became and remains clear that one of the easiest things to express through this ether, the internet, is hostility. That it tend, the medium is the message, and the message of the medium of the internet seems to be more suited toward the expression of criticism and painful thoughts than loving ones. Now, that may be a matter of my perception, but whenever there's one of these attacks and feeding frenzies on someone, when cancel culture comes in full strength, and you see people's colors, that's a lesson. So there's a trust issue that's developing with the internet in those early days. Now, I first attended Burning Man, I think I went to Burning Man 2001, because I got back right before 9/11. But I discovered Burning Man in the late 90s, I think in 98, 99, had a close friend at the time named Jesse Welch went and was sharing thoughts and ideas, and I started looking into it and writing about it, and found the writing of Larry Harvey, the founder, who described Burning Man as an analog of the internet. So he described the Burning Man Festival as taking the internet and putting it on the ground where you could walk around and explore it. And I thought that's a brilliant idea, that we're meeting somewhere and we're going to have all these creative things, and the camps are kind of like websites, and there's central locations where people can meet. And my experience of the first Burning Man was that it was a mellow, humane place, right? This is almost the 20th century. And then the whole world becomes an analog of the internet. So he was right in his observation that Burning Man was an exploration of the digital sphere in physical form, consciously. But that spread, and then the world became transformed, because suddenly everyone had these superpowers, and the superpowers were not being used so creatively. And so we start with a discussion over trust, or maybe it wasn't really discussed very often. And this morphs into a kind of a trance consciousness that starts to take over, because wherever there's a lack of creativity and curiosity and active, loving input, the environment will degrade into a trance and a kind of a hostile trance, generally speaking, or just one made of distractions. And now we are all transformed by this medium, whether we touch the stuff or not. Every person is affected by the literacy of their time, of the technological advances of their time, the time we are in. We are all sharing this one same environment in which the internet is ubiquitous, the digital is a ubiquitous part of it, reaching into every last facet of life. Even if you don't have the thing seemingly coming into your house, you're still overwhelmed by the rays and the telephones are now all on the internet. There's very few copper pairs left. I guess if you live in maybe in rural Arkansas, maybe you're still lucky enough to get an old-fashioned copper pair for your telephone wire, an analog phone line. But pretty much everything is VoIP now, voice over internet. And so we're all completely under this ocean. And we're all still human. Though someone might argue with that. But we are human. We are in our bodies, and we have the feelings that humans have, despite the best efforts of whoever and whatever and why ever to extinguish that, to quell that, to snuff that out. We remain human, and there are many people who are really, really human and really, really want to connect. They have not lost that desire to connect. And connecting over the digital realm is not enough. And it's not enough for anyone in a body. You might think that it is. But as I suggested last week, if you love dogs, all the dog videos in the world or interacting with a dog on a computer monitor or a robotic dog, you throw a pretend stick and it fetches it, are not a dog who you hug and who loves you and who you can feel and just feel his or her body heat and respond to their hunger when they want to eat and love them and take care of them and go places with them and do things and get into bed with them and watch TV, whatever. None of that can be replaced by the digital realm. And if we think our human relationships can be, to me, this is a sign of what some call dehumanization. So here we are in this environment. And my question from a tantric standpoint is, how do we reckon with, deal, I don't want to say overcome, but it may be about overcoming the problems of trust and the trance and the increasing lack of familiarity of not having contact with people, visceral physical contact of a kind that we need and that is a skill set. It is a whole set of skills, the ability to interact with people in person, to converse with them, to sense their boundaries, to be able to make plans and do things and to work out the physical needs when we're together. Right? Who wants to eat what? Who has to go home? Who has a car? Who? How do we do this? And all of these are skills, and they are rapidly evolving and deteriorating as everything starts to go digital, including getting a ride from people. Now that's Lyft and Uber. In many places, I know there are some people still driving each other around, but it's slowly being the whole concept of helping each other, actually, without monetary transaction. Dinner parties. Now, this is a few years old, but there's an app where you can have a dinner party and bill your friends for the food that they ate at your house. or charge them in advance. It's like a Ticketmaster, for your living room. We're not on the same planet that we were in very, very recently. And relationships, that is to say, relating, requires awareness and trust and contact. And these things all take practice. They take people setting examples for us. There's experiments and risks involved. And everything doesn't happen automatically, like touching an icon of an app on the screen and suddenly the thing launches and you've got this whole new little reality that you're in, and it's perfect because it's been bug tested and all that stuff. We the analog world is an imperfect world compared to the technical illusion of perfection of the digital world, the predictability of the digital world. None of those things exist in quite the same way in the analog world, where we are people. And now we need to remember that we're people remembering how to be people. We are either recovering skills that were lost, remembering skills that were lost, or we are hearing about, maybe from older people, hearing about skills that existed in another time that we really, really need now. And, you know, when people want something, they're fairly quick learners, and when there's good examples around, they're fairly quick learners. After a year of complete COVID angst and social distancing and masking and fear and lockdowns and all the restaurants being closed, in around late November of last year, I went to my first event at what is now being called ArcLight, which was, I was invited to be the recording technician, recording Dr. Andrew Kaufman and Thomas Cowan, who met that day. I was standing in the room when they met for the first time. And I was a recording tech. And so suddenly I'm not in my house anymore, and got to bring all my gear, you know, the portable studio and set up in a place. And suddenly I am among all these people all of a sudden, and no one's wearing masks and no one's distancing and no one gives a shit. They've all figured out that there's nothing going on that they need to even meekly be worried about. And the potluck food is pouring in, and the crowd is gathering, and suddenly there were something like 130 of us packed into this room having a virology lesson. And that was my kind of shock test of whether I believed in this whole thing or not. And I went, and you know, I still wasn't sure if there was a virus in November. I knew most of what I know now, but I still wasn't sure. Oh, maybe there's... And yet, nobody gets anything. I've been back 10 times, 10 different events at ArcLight. There's nothing. There's discussion lists and nothing. So, first of all, it is possible to overcome the fear that's been flogged into us the past year and a half, and to remember your social skills, and to trust people, and to hug them, and to eat food with them, and to not be essentially a victim of what is, in truth, nonstop abuse. But this abuse is having its effect on the entire social realm. New divides are being ripped open every day. The current new divide is who got the shot and who didn't get the shot. And the people who got the shot are for some reason afraid of the people who didn't get it. when there's not any way, you know, this is like the person who thinks they're wearing a bulletproof outfit being afraid of the BB gun, and the people who are just refusing to do this are made nervous for scientifically sound reasons by the people who've had the injection. Another rip in society. Who can go to that thing? Who cannot go to that thing? Well, I'm not going to be your friend because you're not, you didn't do this thing. This is some serious attack on the natural flow of social events. I mean, I once had a roommate tell me, don't bring any AIDS fags home. Okay. That's stupid and homophobic and ridiculous. This is that to the millionth power. People excluding relatives from the dinner table. The sacrosanct family dinner table. This is a radical transformation in society. People blocked off from their elders, blocked off from their young, blocked off from their grandchildren. And so this is affecting the totality of the human sphere of relationships. And we might wonder how in the middle of all of this mistrust and rage and anger and sanity and division and fear as a mandatory state, how then are we going to find the trust and the presence of mind to engage with one another lovingly and, yes, sexually? I have said before, and I'll say again, that I think the word love should be set aside. And instead, we should use in its place trust and respect. Where there's trust and respect, there will be love. Love is contaminated and colored by all different kinds of uses of the word and the expectation that it's somehow, you know, exclusive romantic love and this the love and that. And it's like love really, as far as I can see, having thought about it a while and watched a lot of people, as Bob Dylan said, injured by love and injured by hatred. To me, love is trust and respect. And these are states of mind that themselves require trust and respect. You've got to have a little to prime the pump and you know, be open enough and honoring enough of the autonomy of a person in a time when we're being told over and over again that you've got to control what that person does. You've got to tell that person what to do and treat them with hostility if they don't do the thing that you're telling them to do. You have a right to exclude them. You have a right to treat them as less than a person. Think, well, that's them. The thing is that this is part of the digital milieu. This is part of COVID is nothing more than an extension of the digital milieu. It is just what happened during digital with a new name and a bunch of seemingly new behaviors, which are not new behaviors. The distancing and the masking always existed in different forms in this digital realm and before it in different forms as well. But masking, this is digital 101, masking, cloaking your identity, privacy. Now, this leads to another thought. It is possible to have a relationship with someone where no part of the real intimate content of the relationship is exchanged on the internet. But for the most part, there is an exchange of stuff. Ideas, words, desires, promises, requests, photos, photo projects done in the motel room on vacation or, you know, in this kind of thing. And sexting is an old thing. Even old ladies know what sexting is, right? It's like, oh, sexting. Oh, right. And what this has created is an environment where those things can be exposed. And so we have seen many instances of, well, look at that person's text messages to that person. with legal or not legal, doesn't matter. It's all it all ends up getting thrown in the same boat. One of the kind of laws of the internet is that legal and illegal, not such a big difference in digital consciousness. And many people decide they're cops, but in digital consciousness, which has permeated everything, there is always the feeling that everything could all come out. We know that it can. We've seen it many, many times over. All of the persecution of people for what they texted or emailed, and photos, you know, revenge posting of photos. And it's not enough to say, well, just don't take pictures. Because even if you don't take pictures, the feeling of anything we say or do could be exposed is enough to really throw cold water on things for people. It is quite an inhibiting factor. And so this presents people who want to explore, to tantrically explore their relationships, with a challenge. And the challenge is to be ready to have anything you say or reveal be potentially exposed to society. Whatever that is, all of your friends, whatever, the world itself, to wind up on a porno site or whatever it might be, you have to do this, to be tantric in the age of the internet is in a sense the challenge of what it meant to be tantric other times, but particularly pointed now. That you have to be willing to stand in your truth sufficiently that you don't fear exposure of these truths about yourself that you reveal. Whatever form they are in, whether it's digital or not, it's all the same thing because we're in the environment. But, you know, okay, even what you say to people, you know, what you show them, what they show you, we have to be in our truth enough to not be afraid that the whole world might see that and might know that. When I was living in Brussels, the end of my European tour, around maybe the spring of 2007, I received an email from somebody I'd been corresponding with. You know, I've established many deep internet relationships that have been consciously trusting relationships, and it's partly who I am, and I you know, study the territory, and people open up to me. And anyway, had a beautiful conversation going with this woman, and then one day I get an email from her with 25 photos in it, open copied. Everyone in her address book, probably 100, 150 people, got this email. And the first thing I thought was, wow, my friend's really opening up and she's sharing her whole life with everyone. And then I realized, or I asked her, I wrote back and said, you know, so what's up? She said, my husband found out that I was having an affair and published all these photos. And it was photos of her having every imaginable kind of sex with him, and photos he took of her masturbating. And her parents, school administrators, employers, everyone she emailed got these. He got into her system and emailed them to everyone. Now, this is a crime. It's mean, it's stupid, and it's a tantric initiation. And it's a reminder that to be in the times we are in and to be in your truth, you have to be ready to be in your truth all the time. And I wished I had followed up with her as the years went on. That was a few computers ago. And my European computers didn't make it home. My laptop did. My desktop, I think, wound up at an art cooperative. So I don't know what became of her and her life and how this influenced her. And I made one piece of art connected to that incident. I photographed my monitor in context with one of the photos of her, which I see every now and then. Now, this would be... The mere thought of this, to some, is going to be traumatizing. And the people whose, you know, ex-boyfriends publish all the photos on the Tattle photo site, you know, there's like basically kind of underground porno sites where people do this. You know, they dump the photos of the relationship that ended onto this thing. It can also happen inadvertently. If somebody loses their camera, there's upload sites where, you know, like ifoundyourcamera.com, I think, is one of them, where people just put the entire CF card up on the internet where anything that you photographed could be visible to the world. And these boyfriend, girlfriend type experiences are traumatizing to people. And They might even be so if you had previously contemplated the idea of being known for who you are. But I would say that the despite whatever's happened to people in the past, the tantric posture now is to be ready to stand in your truth before anyone at any time. And that, unlike an other times in history where there was plenty of gossip and exposure and people getting the scarlet letter branded on them and God knows what was real and what was not real, we're in a special time now where the actual documentary evidence can be distributed. And for most people, their parents actually knowing how they masturbate or how they like to fuck or, you know, going down on someone, it's not really on their agenda. But the thing is, the reality is, it can happen. Once something's on the internet, in any form, it's on the internet. The cloud. It's all gas permeable, and the copies can be made. And so this presents a special challenge for those who want to rise to it consciously. And this is what I'm proposing here, that the tantric approach to sex now is or includes as one of its most dominant important features the ability to basically stand naked in front of the whole universe. In your words, audio, video, depiction of what you've done in any form, descriptions, offered as proof. And this is a special challenge, but there are some people who figured out that this is really interesting. The very first tantric, let's say, text that I worked with was written by a guy then known as Anand Virjwar, whose real name is William Pennell Rock, and the article is called "Jealousy in the Abyss." And this article has such a profound influence on me, and I was only dimly aware that it was a tantric text. I mean, it was written in the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, and it was a discussion of jealousy and adopting jealousy as a teacher. And this may have been the first kind of direct exposure to a tantric concept that I had had and you know, had directly experienced, and I made hundreds upon hundreds of copies and gave them out, and then was responsible for resurrecting this piece from the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, and with William Pennell Rock's permission, put it on Planet Waves, and then numerous websites have copied it from Planet Waves over the years. But Keiko, I think Keiko Ito personally typed it in, I'm pretty sure. An old friend of mine who was sitting next to me when I posted the first Planet Waves website. And one of the things he says in this article is only truth is erotic. And he says this in the context of why it is so smothering to lie, to live a life of mendacity, to cover up how you feel and what you do, meaning largely to cover up other sexual relationships and even just basic affection. And the monster that we seem to be up against all the time is jealousy. And what he's explaining is that to get over that, you have to be willing to live in your truth all the time. And this does not necessarily make it easy to get a date. People want to quickly go into the trance of you and me forever, nothing ever happened in the past, nothing will ever happen in the future. And through working with this, and, you know, I had reason to be jealous at the time that Joe gave me the article, I had this really astonishing girlfriend named Sabine. Just imagine like a really wild French woman, curvy and Aquarius with Libra rising and I think a Leo moon and juicy hair out to here. And the kind of woman where she just walks in the room and like everyone's like, oh, and this is my lover for a while. And one of my early, you know, tantric teachers. And there was no containing her in the sense that, you know, unfortunately, I like the feeling of everyone just falling in love with and falling in lust with her all the time. And so our relationship went on for a while. And then we met someone named Michelle and started having a relationship among the three of us, and the women having, first of all, being wide open and really beautiful people, fell in love with each other. And so I had to encounter this, had to embrace this. It was a kind of a devastating jealousy, because the whole idea of the relationship that existed before then was completely transformed into a new form. And then there was another lover that she was with, this guy John, and I knew John. I was in his circle of friends, and it's like, you know, suddenly I'm right in the thick of this, and yet wanting to stay in a loving space, wanting to stay in a sexual space, not wanting to shut down. And fortunately, I had Joe's guidance. And fortunately, Joe hands me Jealousy and the Abyss. And I spent that whole summer studying. And so it was 29 years ago I got this thing. And it's still teaching me that's a tantric text. And it was written by a high master. Whatever you may think of Rajneesh, he was the top Swami of Rajneesh, and Pennell says the only who was a real teacher despite all the press that he's gotten and all this stuff. It is impossible to get the real story in public. And yes, things got ugly in the end, and Pennell's one regret was that he didn't get out before all that went down. However, he was the only Swami allowed to keep transcripts of his meetings with Rajneesh. I mean, it would be incredible to read these things of this, you know, high Swami and his teacher talking. So, only truth is erotic, and jealousy is a teacher. And between those, it's possible to start finding a place where you can open up a space of trusting existence, which is what you have to do when you are in a tantric state of mind. That's what it is. It is about the experiment and trusting experience and doing so in a sexual context. And of course, there is so much that can go wrong, and our faculties of trust are calcified by all of this mistrust, and they are under severe attack right now. Under severe attack right now. And people that I genuinely love and would love to share with have been injected, and there's no way that I can get that stuff in my body. I'm too cautious. It frightens me more than any sexually transmitted infection ever did. And so this, again, is divisive of humanity, and it is intentionally so. Nothing with this precise effect is an accident. And so, personally, I find myself having to navigate this new terrain, given the man that I am, opportunities for loving and sharing can be few and far between, because whatever it might be, I'm considered intimidating or whatever. This just is like devastating on one level, and on another level, at least it focuses the conversation. And I know my value. I know where I stand. I have my criteria. And I think we all need to have our criteria for when sexual sharing may be appropriate. We get to the maybe here, and then we go to we explore the is. And of course, there are going to be exceptions to almost every almost every precept. But it's good to know your values. It's good to know which way, where you stand, so that you can have an honest conversation with someone else and say where you stand and hear where they stand and figure out if this thing is right for both of you. And the automatic quality of the relationships that we're having, these Tindery, grindery things where it's like swipe left, swipe right. I'm three blocks away from you. I'm like, oh, I don't know. I want to smell the person's hair. It's not appearance matters to me, but I want to know what this person smells like. I want to see how this person moves before I even express interest in them. Part of the computer thing is, you don't need that. You just need a public relations photo. You just need a headshot. You can pick the person based on a headshot. That is, in my view, really on the numb side. So, still, though, there is this possibility that I think is the tantric edge, that anything said and done could be published. And people have never had this kind of publishing power before. Never could someone just start a Twitter account or a fake Reddit account and ask a question that goes globally or make a statement that goes globally viral. Never before. No, you had to be Banksy or discovered by Ezra Pound or Andy Warhol to be able to get that much exposure for your ideas. So we're in this time when anything can be released. And so if you put yourself into that framework and say, ask yourself if you are willing to have yourself be exposed for all that you are, all that you think and say and feel, then I think we can talk about real trust. Now, I recognize this is a long way away from where many people are at. This is not easy terrain to cross. And the mere idea of being so exposed is harrowing and embarrassing. And one of the very first tantric concepts that I learned, right in the same era, when I was given 5 keys to tantra by Joe without even having any idea that he was a tantric master. Just thought he was a therapist. He's like, well, teachings of tantra, because he's erudite and he's read many, many, many books and all that. I thought, well, he's just quoting books he knows and stuff like this. I'll think of what that idea was. Embarrassment. What he said was, which I had experienced, but never like, that's what that is that when you feel embarrassment, that is something that you can go away from or go toward. And most people go away from it. They kind of like hide from themselves or from someone else, or it's like, I think I'm done for the night or something like this. And what Tantra proposes is that you go toward the embarrassment and open up into it, and that is where the deeply pleasurable feelings are all contained, is on the other side of the scrim of embarrassment. And so to cross that scrim, you have to be cast off your fear of judgment, and cast off your fear of what other people might think, and cast off your fear of what's acceptable socially, and what all the imaginary people in your mind might think, and go there and have the experience. And where there is embarrassment, the experience that will be had is generally going to be some sort of submissive experience, not a dominant experience. The sensation of embarrassment or shame or guilt, consciously felt and expressed, and they're all different facets of the same thing, different flavors, different circumstantial use of the same idea, but they're all close together. Embarrassment is the milder, titillating kind. It is a submissive state. You submit yourself to it. You reveal and allow and understand that once you've revealed and allowed, anyone, wherever you can say anything, and that is submissive to existence. The embarrassment, by the way, is a major constituent in what you might think of as the anti-tantric world, because it is the main glue holding together all the wrapping and the threats and the avoidance of intimacy. Embarrassment is like this magical ray field that that keeps everyone little and in their place. And so there is profound liberation in consciously encountering embarrassment. If you've done it, you know, you may have some idea. If you haven't done it, you can experiment. And what you're really experimenting with is your ego and seeing what that's made of, because that's what experiences embarrassment. And if you are brave enough to encounter this, you can then cross the threshold and find yourself transformed into a more relaxed, allowing being. And you can practice if you know, I know that many other people are not as open and as articulate as I am, but practice saying anything intimate or saying something intimate to yourself and imagining this being broadcast. Among the good things that I can say about Chatterbait and this this kind of apotheosis of in silico sex is that it is certainly, whatever else may be going on, people exposing themselves in ways that do not brook modesty. You have to be immodest to do this and therefore overcome your embarrassment. Now, to remain in a tantric space, you have to keep finding your front. You have to keep finding the place where that is. And so it could wear off quickly if you're like, oh, I'm going to do that set of things or that thing, and then that's it. Then I'm not embarrassed anymore. Fine. But to stay awake is to, like, you know, gently lick off the layer of, you know, the embarrassment scrim, and keep working your way into yourself and understanding what the limitations are about, and giving yourself permission to be the person who you actually are, not the person filtered by publicists, not the person filtered by extremely selective sharing, but venturing into what would be called inappropriate territory. And the way that all of this has been politicized, and there can be public trials over whether that text message from 5 years ago was appropriate, this may take some courage, but I think that more than taking courage, it is about creating courage and learning, because to be who you are always requires courage, which means coming from your heart. Here in Leo time, that's what I have for you tonight. I'm reachable, EFC, at bookofblue.com. That's the inbox that gets the least mail for some reason. EFC at bookofblue.com. Let's go out with one of my beloved Neil Young songs from Rust Never Sleeps. There is a whole story about this. This is not merely a bunch of pretty metaphors. This is him documenting an event at the Oscars involving Marlon Brando. The song is called Pocahontas. All right. Thank you so much for sharing this time with me. And bye for now.
Aurora Borealis, the icy sky at night, paddles cut the water in a long and hurried flight from the white man to the fields of green and the homeland we've never seen. They killed us in our teepees and they cut our